The elderly, thick-set man on the far side of the table leaned forward and stared at him with piercing gray eyes. They made Stormgren so uncomfortable that he spoke first, something he had not intended to do.
"I suppose you've come to discuss terms. What's my ransom?"
He noticed that in the background someone was taking down his words in a shorthand notebook. It was all very businesslike. The leader replied in a musical Welsh accent.
"You could put it that way, Mr. Secretary General, but we're interested in information, not cash."
So that was it, thought Stormgren. He was a prisoner of war, and this was his interrogation.
"You know what our motives are," continued the other in his softly lilting voice. "Call us a resistance movement, if you like. We believe that sooner or later, Earth will have to fight for its independence. But we realize that the struggle can only be by indirect methods, such as sabotage and disobedience. We kidnapped you, partly to show Karelin that we mean business and are well organized, but largely because you are the only man who can tell us anything of the Overlords. You're a reasonable man, Mr. Stormgren. Give us your cooperation, and you can have your freedom." "Exactly what do you wish to know?" asked Stormgren cautiously.
Those extraordinary eyes seemed to search his mind to its depths. They were unlike any that Stormgren had ever seen in his life. Then the sing-song voice replied,
"Do you know who, or what, the Overlords really are?"
Stormgren almost smiled.
"Believe me," he said, "I'm quite as anxious as you to discover that."
"Then you'll answer our questions?"
"I make no promises, but I may."
There was a slight sigh of relief from Joe, and a rustle of anticipation ran round the room.
"We have a general idea," continued the other, "of the circumstances in which you meet Karelin. But perhaps you would describe them carefully, leaving out nothing of importance."
That was harmless enough, thought Stormgren. He had done it many times before, and it would give the appearance of cooperation. There were acute minds here, and perhaps they could uncover something new. They were welcome to any fresh information they could extract from him, so long as they shared it. That it could harm Karelin in any way, he did not for a moment believe. Stormgren felt in his pockets and produced a pencil and an old envelope. Sketching rapidly while he spoke, he began.
"You know, of course, that a small flying machine with no obvious means of propulsion calls for me at regular intervals and takes me up to Karelin's ship. It enters the hull, and you've doubtless seen the telescopic films that have been taken of that operation. The door opens again, if you can call it the door, and I go into a small room with a table, a chair, and a vision screen. The layout is something like this."
He pushed the plan across to the old Welshman, but the strange eyes never turned towards it. They were still fixed on Stormgren's face, and as he watched them, something seemed to change in their depths. The room had become completely silent, but behind him he heard Joe take a sudden indrawn breath. Puzzled and annoyed, Stormgren stared back at the other, and as he did so, understanding slowly dawned. In his confusion, he crumpled the envelope into a ball of paper and ground it underfoot. He knew now why those gray eyes had affected him so strangely. The man opposite him was blind. Van Ryberg had made no further attempts to contact Karelin. Much of his department's work, the forwarding of statistical information, the abstracting of the world's press, and the like, had continued automatically. In Paris, the lawyers were still wrangling over the proposed world constitution, but that was none of his business for the moment. It was a fortnight before the supervisor wanted the final draft. If it was not ready by then, no doubt Karelin would take what action he thought fit. And there was still no news of Stormgren. Van Ryberg was dictating when the emergency-only telephone started to ring. He grabbed the receiver and listened with mounting astonishment, then threw it down and rushed to the open window. In the distance, cries of amazement were rising from the streets, and traffic was slowing to a halt. It was true. Karelin's ship, that never-changing symbol of the Overlords, was no longer in the sky.
He searched the heavens as far as he could see and found no trace of it. Then, suddenly, it seemed as if night had swiftly fallen. Coming down from the north, its shadowed underbelly black as a thundercloud, the great ship was racing low over the towers of New York. Involuntarily, Van Ryberg shrank away from the onrushing monster. He had always known how huge the ships of the overlords really were, but it was one thing to see them far away in space, and quite another to watch them passing overhead like demon-driven clouds. In the darkness of that partial eclipse, he watched until the ship and its monstrous shadow had vanished into the south. There was no sound, not even the whisper of air, and Van Ryberg realized that despite its apparent nearness, the ship had passed at least a kilometer above his head. Then the building shuddered once as the shockwave struck it, and from somewhere came the tinkling of broken glass as a window blew inwards. In the office behind him, all the telephones had started to ring, but Van Ryberg did not move. He remained leaning against the window ledge, still staring into the south, paralyzed by the presence of illimitable power. As Stormgren talked, it seemed to him that his mind was operating on two levels simultaneously. On the one hand, he was trying to defy the men who had captured him, yet on the other, he was hoping that they might help him unravel Karelin's secret. It was a dangerous game, yet to his surprise, he was enjoying it. The blind Welshman had conducted most of the interrogation. It was fascinating to watch that agile mind trying one opening after another, testing and rejecting all the theories that Stormgren himself had abandoned long ago. Presently, he leaned back with a sigh. "We're getting nowhere," he said resignedly. "We want more facts, and that means action, not argument." The sightless eyes seemed to stare thoughtfully at Stormgren. For a moment, he tapped nervously on the table. It was the first sign of uncertainty Stormgren had noticed. Then he continued. "I'm a little surprised, Mr. Secretary, that you've never made any effort to learn more about the overlords." "What do you suggest?" asked Stormgren coldly, trying to disguise his interest. "I've told you that there's only one way out of the room in which I have my talks with Karelin, and that leads straight back to Earth." "It might be possible," mused the other, "to devise instruments which could teach us something. I'm no scientist, but we can look into the matter. If we give you your freedom, would you be willing to assist with such a plan?" "Once and for all," said Stormgren angrily, "let me make my position perfectly clear. Karelin is working for a united world, and I'll do nothing to help his enemies. What his ultimate plans may be, I don't know, but I believe that they are good." "What real proof have we of that?" "All his actions, ever since his ships appeared in our skies. I defy you to mention one act that, in the ultimate analysis, hasn't been beneficial." Stormgren paused for a moment, letting his mind run back through the past years. Then he smiled. "If you want a single proof of the essential, how shall I put it, benevolence of the overlords, think of that cruelty to animals order which they made within the month of their arrival. If I had had any doubts about Karelin before, that banished them, even though that order has caused me more trouble than anything else he's ever done." That was scarcely an exaggeration, Stormgren thought. The whole incident had been an extraordinary one, the first revelation of the overlord's hatred of cruelty. That, and their passion for justice and order, seemed to be the dominant emotions in their lives, as far as one could judge them by their actions. And it was the only time Karelin had shown anger, or at least the appearance of anger. "You may kill one another if you wish," the message had gone, "and that is a matter between you and your own laws. But if you slay, except for food or in self-defense, the beasts that share your world with you, then you may be answerable to me." No one knew exactly how comprehensive this ban was supposed to be, or what Karelin would do to enforce it. They had not long to wait. The Plaza de Toros was full when the matadors and their attendants began their processional entry. Everything seemed normal. The brilliant sunlight blazed harshly on the traditional costumes. The great crowd greeted its favorites as it had 100 times before. Yet here and there, faces were turned anxiously towards the sky, to the aloof, silver shape 50 kilometers above Madrid. Then the picadors had taken up their places, and the bull had come snorting out into the arena. The skinny horses, nostrils wide with terror, had wheeled in the sunlight as their riders forced them to meet their enemy. The first lance flashed, made contact, and at that moment came a sound that had never been heard on earth before. It was the sound of 10,000 people screaming with the pain of the same wound. 10,000 people who, when they had recovered from the shock, found themselves completely unharmed. But that was the end of that bullfight, and indeed of all bullfighting, for the news spread rapidly. It is worth recording that the aficionados were so shaken that only 1 in 10 asked for his money back, and also that the London Daily Mirror made matters much worse by suggesting that the Spaniards adopt cricket as a new national sport.
"You may be correct," the old Welshman replied. "Possibly the motives of the overlords are good, according to their standards, which may sometimes be the same as ours. But they are interlopers. We never asked them to come here and turn our world upside down, destroying ideals, yes, and nations, that generations of men have fought to protect. I come from a small nation that had to fight for its liberties," retorted Stormgren. "Yet, I am for Karelin. You may annoy him. You may even delay the achievement of his aims, but it will make no difference in the end. Doubtless you are sincere in believing as you do. I can understand your fear that the traditions and cultures of little countries will be overwhelmed when the world state arrives, but you are wrong. It is useless to cling to the past. Even before the overlords came to Earth, the sovereign state was dying. They have merely hastened its end. No one can save it now, and no one should try."
There was no answer. The man opposite neither moved nor spoke. He sat with lips half open, his eyes now lifeless as well as blind. Around him the others were equally motionless, frozen in strained, unnatural attitudes. With a gasp of pure horror, Stormgren rose to his feet and backed away towards the door. As he did so, the silence was suddenly broken.
"That was a nice speech, Ricky. Thank you. Now I think we can go."
Stormgren spun on his heels and stared into the shadowed corridor. Floating there, at eye level, was a small, featureless sphere. The source, no doubt, of whatever mysterious force the overlords had brought into action. It was hard to be certain, but Stormgren imagined that he could hear a faint humming, as of a hive of bees on a drowsy summer day.
"Karelin! Thank God! But what have you done?"
"Don't worry. They're all right. You can call it a paralysis, but it's much subtler than that. They're simply living a few thousand times more slowly than normal. When we've gone, they'll never know what happened."
"You'll leave them here until the police come?"
"No. I've a much better plan. I'm letting them go."
Stormgren felt a surprising sense of relief. He gave a last, valedictory glance at the little room and its frozen occupants. Joe was standing on 1 foot, staring very stupidly at nothing. Suddenly Stormgren laughed and fumbled in his pockets.
"Thanks for the hospitality, Joe," he said. "I think I'll leave a souvenir."
He ruffled through the scraps of paper until he had found the figures he wanted. Then, on a reasonably clean sheet, he wrote carefully, "Bank of Manhattan. Pay Joe the sum of $135.50. R. Stormgren." As he laid the strip of paper beside the pole, Karelin's voice inquired,
"Exactly what are you doing?"
"We Stormgrens always pay our debts. The other two cheated, but Joe played fair. At least, I never caught him cheating."
He felt very gay and lightheaded, and quite 40 years younger as he walked to the door. The metal sphere moved aside to let him pass. He assumed that it was some kind of robot, and it explained how Karelin had been able to reach him through the unknown layers of rock overhead. Go straight ahead for 100 meters, said the sphere, speaking in Karelin's voice. Then turn to the left until I give you further instructions. He strode forward eagerly, though he realized that there was no need for hurry. The sphere remained hanging in the corridor, presumably covering his retreat. A minute later, he came across a second sphere, waiting for him at a branch in the corridor. You've 1/2 kilometer to go, it said. Keep to the left until we meet again. 6 times he encountered the spheres on his way to the open. At first, he wondered if, somehow, the robot was managing to keep ahead of him. Then he guessed that there must be a chain of the machines maintaining a complete circuit down into the depths of the mine. At the entrance, a group of guards formed a piece of improbable statuary, watched over by yet another of the ubiquitous spheres. On the hillside, a few meters away, lay the little flying machine in which Stormgren had made all his journeys to Karelin. He stood for a moment, blinking in the sunlight. Then he saw the ruined mining machinery around him, and beyond that a derelict railway stretching down the mountainside. 7 kilometers away, a dense forest lapped at the base of the mountain, and very far off, Stormgren could see the gleam of water from a great lake. He guessed that he was somewhere in South America, though it was not easy to say exactly what gave him that impression. As he climbed into the little flying machine, Stormgren had a last glimpse of the mine entrance and the men frozen around it. Then the door sealed behind him, and with a sigh of relief, he sank back upon the familiar couch. For a while, he waited until he had recovered his breath. Then he uttered a single, heartfelt syllable.
Well?
I'm sorry I couldn't rescue you before, but you see how very important it was to wait until all the leaders had gathered here.
Do you mean to say, spluttered Stormgren, that you knew where I was all the time? If I thought—
Don't be too hasty, answered Karelin. At least, let me finish explaining.
Very good, said Stormgren darkly. I'm listening.
He was beginning to suspect that he had been no more than bait in an elaborate trap.
I've had a, perhaps tracer is the best word for it, on you for some time, began Karelin. Though your late friends were correct in thinking that I couldn't follow you underground, I was able to keep track until they brought you to the mine. That transfer in the tunnel was ingenious, but when the first car ceased to react, it gave the plan away, and I soon located you again. Then it was merely a matter of waiting. I knew that once they were certain I'd lost you, the leaders would come here, and I'd be able to trap them all.
But you're letting them go.
Until now, said Karelin. I had no way of telling who of the 2.5 billion men on this planet were the real heads of the organization. Now that they're located, I can trace their movements anywhere on Earth, and can watch their actions in detail if I want to. That's far better than locking them up. If they make any moves, they'll betray their remaining comrades. They're effectively neutralized, and they know it. Your rescue will be completely